This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodl Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
I'm here with Professor Anne Zablodoff of the University of Arizona, and welcome to the Jodcast.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Now, you deal with a lot of mysteries, it seems, don't you? Could you tell us a bit about your work?
Yes, I'm not a detective novelist, but there's certainly enough to give us job security for many a long career in astronomy. And in fact, it's a really exciting time to be an astronomer because the technology over the last 10 or 15 years has just blossomed to the point where detectors are more sensitive and reaching wavelengths they were unable to do previously. Telescopes have grown bigger. We have things in space that get above our atmosphere and see deeper and lower surface brightness objects than ever before. So there are still many mysteries, and mysteries breed more mysteries, but we at least have the hope of advancing some of the knowledge in the field. And one of the mysteries in which I'm currently working in a project that's actually being led by a former student of mine, Eugene Yang, who's doing all the hard work and having all the good ideas. He's at the Max Planck Institute for Astronomy now in Heidelberg, and I've actually just returned from a visit with him, which was very illuminating. And also very, very frustrating because there's, again, so much that we don't know, particularly about the high redshift universe, which has just become a little more accessible to us. So one of the things that we have been discussing are these so-called extended Lyman Alpha nebulae, which are more colloquially referred to as blobs. And they were discovered by Chuck Steidel in his work on Lyman Break galaxies not too long ago. And since that time, our knowledge of galaxies at high redshift, and nowadays when we talk about high redshift, we're talking about redshift 2, 3, 4, 8 and above, has grown, but I think faster than our understanding of this extended gas and its emission that we're seeing now out to redshifts of about 3, possibly out to redshifts of about 6. There have been claims. There is a claim of a detection of one of these hundreds of kiloparsec blobs of gas illuminated somehow and emitting Lyman alpha radiation at a redshift of around 6.
Okay, so what is the composition of these blobs of gas?
Well, that's an excellent question. We know they have hydrogen based on what they're emitting, but the problem is that any other lines have been problematic because the Lyman alpha line is the strongest line, and that's frequently where these objects are detected. And I collaborated on a theoretical paper with Ramil Dave, who's a colleague of mine, and again, Eugene, leading the project, in which we really reached hard to find examples of other lines that, while not as bright as Lyman alpha, might still be detectable. Because one of the problems with Lyman alpha is it's a resonant line, it's optically thick, and as a result of that, when you detect it, although bright, we don't really know where those photons originated in the system, and they've had some torturous path by which they managed to escape it finally, but it's not that we literally get to the heart of the matter. We don't see through these systems. We don't understand the bulk motions of the gas and the flows in these systems from the Lyman alpha alone. And unfortunately, that's generally all that gets detected. So we've written a paper suggesting, well, let's look at the next most abundant element in the universe, helium, and see whether or not there might be helium lines that would be useful for study that would be optically thin. And also, there are other lines of hydrogen, like H-alpha, hydrogen H-alpha, that are optically thin, or are likely, more likely to be, that would be worthwhile to detect. And so one of the projects in which I've been involved is actually to look at infrared wavelengths now for H-alpha to see if that line is detectable, and then compare the H-alpha to Lyman alpha to try to get a better handle even on the most basic question of whether the gas is more or less falling or outflowing in these blobs. Because there are many, many theories at the moment as to what the source of this Lyman alpha radiation is. Again, we know the extent of the blob is on the order of 100 kiloparsecs or so. So what is that? Why don't why doesn't every galaxy that's observed at high redshift have such a blob of gas around it? Maybe they do, maybe it's not always illuminated, maybe their environment is such that that gas is not present. So there are a lot of questions, but there are many predictions as to what the source of this Lyman alpha should be, and many of them hinge on whether that gas is principally outflowing or inflowing. So, for example, people think that maybe there's an AGN in a galaxy in the center of one of these blobs that's photoionizing the environment around it. Maybe there are galactic or supergalactic winds that are driving shocks that could be exciting this emission. But then there's also a school that suggests that, and this is mostly coming from the theoretical community, that there's cooling radiation when there's gravitational infall of gas into, say, a forming galaxy, and that some of that cooling radiation gets channeled into certain emission lines, one of them being Lyman alpha. So again, you can understand just even knowing whether the gas is flowing out in general or flowing in would help one distinguish among those possibilities. And we don't even know that because Lyman alpha, again, is the object, the line that usually gets detected. So we've been trying to measure other lines. We have now succeeded in measuring H-alpha in a whopping 2 blobs. It's difficult work. We're using the largest telescopes in the world. And our preliminary results are that there's no dramatic, using very simplistic, I should say, theoretical models, there's no dramatic evidence for big outflows or big inflows in these systems. What we're seeing is characteristic of, you know, the kind of outflows that some people have claimed on the low end of Lyman Break galaxies. So either not much of anything at all, or 100 or 200 kilometers per second outflow near the galaxy, or galaxies that may be embedded in these blobs. But there's no evidence at the moment, anyway, for large-scale outflows of the kind that one might need to generate the kind of shocking that people say might produce this emission. And nor do we see dramatic evidence for infall along the nature of cooling radiation. But there are many, many caveats to these statements, and we're working through them and trying to be as comprehensive as possible in the work we're writing up now. And that is that we've only got 2 blobs. There could be geometric effects by which we're missing infall or outflow along certain directions. Once we get up to 5 or 10 blobs, then those kinds of arguments get a little more clear. And I think there are still questions about what the relevant theoretical models are for these systems. When you're trying to model both Lyman alpha and H alpha, Lyman alpha is particularly hard because of these radiative transfer effects, and we don't know where that gas is relative to what's emitting the H alpha. So it's a complicated problem. We're just getting started. But one of the recent results we have had, which we're slightly more confident of at this point, is that when you compare the statistics of the blobs that we've now found through a technique using a specially designed narrow band filter. So Eugen designed this filter. We had it made. And it's particularly good at detecting blobs in a narrow redshift window because it's a narrow wavelength filter. And as a result of that, we can choose our favorite redshift, one that is not a place in the spectrum where a lot of night sky lines or atmospheric absorption becomes a problem for us. And so you have some wiggle room in choosing the appropriate redshift. And once you've done that, in this case, a redshift of about 2.3, you're much more efficient at detecting these extended sources. So it's now possible to find tens or hundreds of these blobs, whereas before a few bright ones were known. So for the first time, you have the opportunity to say, this is the number density, is our volume is well-defined because of the narrow band search, or this is the variance in that number density. So I look in one place and I've got this many blobs, they either do or don't pile up in my field, and I look in another place and it's a very different count or a similar count. So there's some inherent variance. And depending upon that combination of number density and variants, you can ask yourself if blobs occupy dark matter halos, and they all more or less occupy the same mass dark matter halo, what do n-body simulations of cosmology then predict the likely halo mass that those blobs occupy is? And what we found is that halo mass tends to be most likely around a 10 to the 13th solar mass halo. And at redshifts between 2 and 3, that's hefty.
Okay.
And so what that suggests is, and in fact we know what those halos become in the nearby universe, and they tend to become 10 to the 14th solar mass halos and above. So we really feel that were this analysis to be correct, we are looking at proto-Virgo clusters, proto-even coma clusters.
These are big clusters of galaxies.
These are big clusters of galaxies. They will become what we consider the real tip of the spectrum of the mass function today. And so the galaxies, or the fragments of galaxies that we resolve barely with even Hubble Space Telescope in the centers of these blobs, are probably represent galaxies that are forming in the most overdense environments at the epoch at which we're looking, and will probably ultimately merge to become the brightest cluster galaxies today, which are the most massive. These giant elliptical galaxies that occupy clusters are the most massive galaxies we know about today. And they're also the systems, by virtue of the fact that these are massive overdensities, that presumably collapsed earliest in the history of the universe. So their stellar populations also may be among the earliest that we can probe. So going both directions in time, back in time and forward in time, these are very interesting systems. And so they're definitely worth following up, even though it's a tough business. And so what we're doing now is we're actually using a very sexy new instrument at the Magellan Telescope at Las Campanas Observatory in Chile, which is a tunable filter instrument, which actually allows you, again, a very narrow wavelength, but to actually pick that wavelength. So instead of investing $20,000 or $15,000 in a filter representing a particular wavelength, we can, within reason, choose particular wavelengths, again, that are right with respect to not getting contaminated by the night sky. And in this particular case, the sensitivity of this detector and the combinations of filter choices and things like that allow us to certain sweet spots in redshift that are not really well accessible to other instruments, even instruments on even bigger telescopes. They're not 6.5 meter, but might be 8 or 10 meter telescopes in the world today. And so we've really been pushing to detect blobs and particularly constrain their statistics now at redshifts of 4, maybe even 5. We haven't done that yet, but we think we have a glimmer of hope to push this out to higher redshifts. And why that's interesting, again, is if they are tracing these overdense regions in large-scale structure at any epoch in which you look at them, then pushing them further and further back, it's very interesting from the evolution, from the standpoint of the evolution of large-scale structure, and again, what these will become, but also when the first stars and the early populations of stars at least got into, baryons in fact, got into the environments today that we now see as among the oldest in the universe. So yeah, we're pretty excited about all this, and it's a crowded field, and there are a lot of people working on these. A lot of big telescope time is being devoted to projects like that, or different aspects to this project, but there's this interesting confluence of data available in the X-ray regime and the IR and the infrared regime and the optical regime now, the rest frame UV. I mean, there are many things that we're learning that we would have been out of the question just a few years ago.
Exciting times ahead. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.